Are we podcasting right now, or are we talking about the podcast? Are we breaking the fifth wall? What's going on? I'm a little bit lost.
Well, howdy, folks. It's Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
Hey, he made it.
He did, didn't he?
Sitting in the lobby for 5 minutes waiting for JJ to accept him.
That's true. Oh, by the way, here, there's the link. All right. So first thing first.
There you go.
So I sent it to CZ. I didn't send it to you, bro, Rick. No love over there. If you didn't know, Brandon is been advocating for our podcast on STT. Have you been hearing that?
No.
What's STT?
Yeah.
I did see you were a guest star on STT.
Yeah.
Software Defined Talk.
Software Defined Talk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. I'm just messing with you.
Well, I know you know, but maybe one of our tens of listeners might not have known.
Dozens. He's been we're officially part of the Cote podcast network.
Isn't that why we've been doing this the whole time?
Yeah, exactly. But the upstream podcast is actually acknowledged what we've been doing, which is really cool. But I figured it would be really fun to start this podcast by Broberg, you first, then CZ, then me, the two sentences to describe what we do on this podcast. Wouldn't that be neat? Like, just so we actually, like, I know we've argued it back and forth many times.
Wait, are we podcasting right now, or are we talking about the podcast? Are we breaking the fifth wall? What's going on? I'm a little bit lost.
That's the,
like, are we live? Are we recording?
This is interdimensional chess. And we're about to get checkmated. Sure, I'll go first. I'd say first off, we Trojan horse a vessel that Cote has curated for many years called Drunk and Retired. While neither one of those titles apply to any of us during the show, we use it as a vessel to talk about technical trends and mostly cooking.
Pretty damn good. CZ.
Look, I mean, I think it's as simple as we are three white dudes. And as soon as you have three white dudes in a conversation together, it just becomes a podcast naturally.
Damn it. That's literally what I was going to say. Oh, man.
I really do just show up to talk to you guys about food once a week and maybe some tech. But if we have to record it, I guess I'll do that too.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say, this is my weekly check-in with two great friends of mine that, you know, we get to talk about what's going on in the industry, and I get to be yelled at about how I'm cooking things wrong. So.
Oh, yeah, that's a very important element. I'm glad you brought up, JJ, because you really are like a heat sink for all my failure around cooking. Like, it just seems to redirect to you very organically, and that's also why I show up. It helps build both my credibility and my confidence.
Hey, Broberg, I'm just a teddy bear, man. All you gotta do is like latch on, and I'll protect you from everything. Don't worry about it.
Oh, okay. I'm into it right now. Thank you.
Nice. Cool. Well, on that note, I heard you went to Asian food market.
Oh yeah, I am. So I'm on a staycation right now. Hint the more hipster than usual look, and actually drinking a beer during this show. It is wonderful, but that's a different subject. The main thing I gave myself to do food wise this week, I just wanted to play around with ramen recipes that I've seen on the internet and like actually give it some attention for a few days and see if I could, you know, figure out something that could be a go-to meal wise. And I, you know, to supply up, like, you got to go to the Asian grocery store. And it's called Shanghai Groceries. Wonderful place. in a part of town I've never been in. That's not the bougie stuff is elsewhere that I normally frequent. And it was just awesome. Like, they just have all the food I love, because all I love eating is like Korean and Vietnamese and Chinese and Japanese food. And lo and behold, if you go to this place, you can actually go get the ingredients for next to nothing price-wise, very reasonable prices. And, you know, just with some Google Translate and a lot of Google searches to make sure you're getting the right can of something, you end up with a bounty. So I came home with a wonderful, wonderful bounty of food.
So you didn't accidentally bring home the whale flavored horse meat?
Or all Pockies, nothing but Pockies.
I haven't opened everything up yet, so I have no idea how much MSG I've had this week. I refuse to look in at the labels too closely. And I'm pretty sure I haven't eaten horse meat, but those beans were suspiciously chewy, so I don't know if they're actually some form of gonad. It beats the hell out of me.
So there's little chipmunk
testicles.
Online Japanese grocer called Sugoi Mart, which is Sugoi is the Japanese word for delicious, I think.
Sugoi.
Awesome. And one of the things they have on there is a can of whale flavored horse meat. Unfortunately, Kelly has said that I am under no circumstances allowed to order it. So I haven't had it yet.
But is there a loophole of somebody ordering it and sending it to your home?
Confirm nor deny.
Let the record show that Paul's hands are in the air. He is neither confirming nor denying that possibility.
Google, so did you grab any random things and were like surprised by them pleasantly?
I tried to stick to with the plan. It was overwhelming enough to try to. I wrote down like three recipes I was looking at. One from The Way of Ramen, another one from like Prickly Pear, which is a food blog. My friend is Chinese American, and she sent me a bunch of her stuff. She's like, "Oh, finally, you're getting into this shit." So I just kind of played the follow along, and I still forgot a couple things, but no, I ended up with just a ton of sauces and some powders and some like Szechuan peppercorn, which was like the only thing I actually knew what that was beforehand. In like the dried shiitakes, I didn't know you could buy such a big bag of dried shiitake mushrooms and just how many recipes call for them. And
it feels like the staple. Yeah, shiitake mushrooms really is a staple of like that region's food, right? Am I wrong on that? Like, I see it everywhere.
Paul, but you're the authority figure on this podcast.
Yeah, I feel like it's the go-to like dried mushroom in a lot of Chinese, especially dishes.
Why is dried mushroom so predominant a flavor profile?
Isn't it for protein?
I think the drying of it is just the like preservation technique, right?
Okay.
So you can package it in a giant bag and let it sit on a shelf for 6 months and it's still okay and edible. Mm-hmm. But also protein, it really,
right?
When it dries out, it really concentrates the umami flavors in it. I think shiitakes in general are pretty high in that kind of umami kind of flavor profile. And then from there, like 20 minutes in hot water and they're basically back to being plump little mushrooms that you can like have in your soup or whatever. And the other thing is the water, the hot water that you soak it in is now this like umami rich, like tea/broth that you can also use to flavor whatever it is you're cooking. So it's just like turns a mushroom into a little flavor bomb. And
so JJ, to answer your question, I just looked up four dried shiitakes, about 15 grams, totals 44 calories, 11 grams of carbs, 2 grams of fiber, and only 1 gram of protein. So I guess it's not like
really?
Protein doesn't seem to be the big source. There's a ton of vitamins that I wouldn't have thought. I didn't think you'd have vitamin B5 in that, or selenium or magnesium and zinc. Like, it has a bunch of like the metals that are good for your blood. So I'm kind of blown away, but I just soaked them overnight with some nigiri in a big pot and used that as the base for the first miso ramen I made, and it was just freaking phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't believe it didn't suck because I have no idea what I'm doing, but it was just so, so flavorful. You really, the first one I oversalted like crazy. And then when I equaled it out, it just tasted wonderful.
Nice. Now, when you were going through it, did you learn that like the difference in like when you're making ramen, you have like kind of the broth and then you have the like the tare?
Yeah. I'm so trying to. Can you elaborate? Do you want to give an intro for people? Because I'm still very noob on this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm far from an expert, but like you've got the broth, which is like the base flavor. So like a tonkotsu broth.
The little
which,
package, right?
Which
the little silver package.
That's right.
When you open up your ramen.
One thing that's worth talking about is like in the West, we have this obsession over like tonkotsu ramen as like the ramen.
Yeah.
Whereas like in Japan, it's like a minor player in the ramens. And so a lot of the ramen you get in Japan is a lot lighter. So it's a simpler like soy sauce based or miso based broth. And we've kind of almost fetishized the tonkotsu side of it. And I think maybe because it's such a like such a strong, unique like flavor and it's thick and it's, I guess, you know.
That's also the pork. I mean, that's the pork bone base broth, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I mean, what's more American than like trying to fatten something up and make more meat to be part of it?
Yeah. So you have that broth, right? And you know, it's either usually like pork bones like tonkotsu, or it's like from dashi, which is kind of the soup base where it's the shaved bonito flakes, seaweed, and maybe some other kind of oceany kind of things. And so you sort of start with a oceany like type thing. And then often you'll do that with like, maybe you'll have that with some like chicken bones and sort of make a like chicken bony broth with the dashi in the background. And that's your broth basis, right? But you also have tare, which is, I think, just kind of a generic like word for like sauce in Japanese, because
that's been my impression from
when
reading.
You make yakitori, you also have tare, which is like the sauce you put, you dip the yakitori skewers in. And I think that's where teriyaki comes from. The teri in part of teriyaki is
sauce,
right?
It's almost like yaki, the words mean something,
is barbecue, right?
Yeah,
that, grill, right?
Does it relate to Tamagotchi? No, now I'm off.
No.
And so the tare is basically like a flavored like oil or similar that you put in towards the end that kind of just like emphasizes or modifies the flavor a little bit, as kind of an additional sauce. And so that's where often you'll get you'll see it with a spicy ramen where they just add like a spicy tare at the end or something like that.
Nice.
And so, you know, any ramen, like in Japan, at least, no matter how basic, you kind of have those two things. You have the base and then you have the tare. And even like the instant ramen, often you get like the flavor, like sachet with like the powdered stuff, which is the stock. But you also often get like a little packet with like a flavored oil.
Right.
And that's the tare, right?
Huh. How about you, JJ? Are you an Asian food frequenter?
The one thing that I actually promised my wife I was going to do this last week or 2 weeks ago, but I never got around to it. So I need to think that you've inspired me to make sure this happens this weekend now. We bought the Korean grill barbecue thingy to sit on our table. So we start doing the Korean barbecue. Like there's a great place in Austin called Korea House that has been around since the dawn of time. And that's a very localized joke for Austinites there. Our kids love the Korean barbecue, on the table thing. And the last time I did it, we bought like the pre-made one that's like already seasoned for, or, sauced for you. And that was phenomenal. They had some really high end, not exactly Wagyu, but really high end, really beautifully marbled strips of short ribs there, and I completely fucked up the sauce. Like, it was a disaster. It was basically like putting like a cup of soy sauce in your mouth and like chewing on meat. It was gross. So I've promised myself I would revisit this so I can get a better season for it. So when we decide to do it again, we can get some really good flavors around it too. So that's kind of the rant.
Yeah. No, I love it. Like, you actually bought the setup. So, and with your kids, that does sound really fun. Yeah. I'd be down for that. I think there's something really magical about like a bulgogi pork that's like grilled right in front of you. I don't know if I'm gonna buy any setups, but
have you got one of those portable like suitcase propane grill things?
You know what?
That's the thing I bought. And those things are cheap.
Yeah, so like 20 bucks, and then you get like a little like flattish metal thing that goes over the top. That's the grill bit. And so like for $40-ish, you basically get the setup, and those little propane burners are so useful. Like, there's so many times I need like an extra like heat source or something in the kitchen when I'm cooking a lot of stuff, and I just whack that on the bench, get it lit up, get something cooking. So I use mine like constantly.
Don't forget, in these end times that are coming very soon, we're all going to need ways to get heat to cook food. And it's in a little carrying case, so you can take it with you when you're running away from the zombies.
But I love the looks. Bring my little charcoal. I mean, my charcoal setup's very portable. It's called a portable kitchen, just to remind you what brand of grill I got. So it's totally foolproof for these moments. That's really cool. This actually brings me to another subject related. So making this miso... or making this ramen setup, it's the first time I've had to use all four burners at the same time to cook something. I am not like an indoor cooker very much. I'm like one pan focused kind of person. So it really strained my attention and timing to get all that going. So Paul, you're saying you use an additional one on top of your stove on a regular basis? Like, how do you manage that, all that?
I mean, usually... if you're using that much stuff, like one of the two of the things are usually either like get like boiling soup for a stock or, braising something. So rarely is there ever anything that like more than one thing that I have to pay like constant close attention to. So I've never really found it to be a problem. And then if you've done your like mise en place properly, like everything is kind of organized around you. So you can kind of focus on like whatever it is, the current thing you have to do without kind of sweating the details around you. And you also kind of get a feel for like smells and sounds. And so like you can smell when like a piece of protein is getting to like a really good like cook on the Maillard reaction. You can like hear a sound difference when something's like reducing down and going from like boiling to frying and stuff like that. So you can kind of start to get, I mean, certainly don't have like a chef's ability to like interpret a kitchen via sight and sound, but certainly you can.
Like, I get some of that. I gotta say, as an audience member listening to what you just said, you just flexed like so much on top of us right now. It was... You use terms that I know only because I'm your friend, I know what they mean, but like missing in place or whatever, I can't even say it properly. That was
the best. Mission in place, did you say? Yeah. That's actually kind of similar.
But yeah, that was damn CZ. Damn.
Yeah, there's nothing subtle about it. Thank you for just calling it what it was. Like,
if I'm awesome, I'm awesome, right?
I mean, there you go.
I gotta own it.
Yeah. You didn't ask for this gift.
Before we close out this little section, next time you go to the Asian grocery store, I want you to look for a couple of things.
Yeah,
one absolutely. Is a can of, it's called canned dace fish with salted black beans. And like just about everyone in China has a can or two of this stuff in their pantry for like when they just got to have a quick snack or they couldn't be bothered making lunch. And the stuff is delicious. And then the other thing is, and this might be harder to find at like a grocery store, unless it's a good Japanese one, but you can get dashi stock in tea bags. And basically one tea bag gives you like half a liter or so, depending on the size of the tea bag, of like really good, rich dashi. And that saves you from like having to get giant bags of like the bonito flakes and the kombu, the katsubushi, all that sort of stuff. And you can kind of just, you know, use these. And a few tares I've made, you actually do like a cold brew of the dashi stock powder in the tea bag, and it's so good.
Wild. So
that's a couple of things you should go for. The other thing, Szechuan peppercorns. So there's red and there's green. Green are a lot more aromatic. And so I always like to, like, I usually use red as the flavor base, but I always like to use a little bit of green to get, like, boost the, like, aroma of them. And so that's another good tip. And you can also get, like, the Szechuan pepper oil, which, like, a drop of it goes a super long way as another way. Because some people don't like having, like, chunks of Szechuan peppercorn to sort of bite into and, like, have that side of their mouth go numb. So
it is such a weird feeling, right? If you've never had Szechuan peppercorns, prepare for like the what I thought Pop Rocks would be like growing up. It's like it actually fulfills that promise.
So what I thought we could do is, Matt, a couple of weeks ago we talked about the idea of doing a new segment where we kind of yes, yes, no kind of thing. So I came up with this idea. For lack of a better name, I'm going to call it Buried the Meme. And basically it's like Buried the Lead, right? So, each week, one of us, if we like it, we'll come up with a, like the title of a news article that they've read that is maybe misleading or doesn't really represent what's in there. And the other two people, just from the title, have to have a guess at what the contents of the article is.
I've prepared for this. I'm so excited.
How does this sound?
Sounds great. Are you good, JJ?
Yeah.
Since I came up with it, I would give it a first go.
Show us how it's done. Please.
And so the title of the article is Locked in an Insecure Cage.
Docker.
Yeah, I was about to say it's going to be like something.
Or do we have to like work together?
Yeah.
However you want. Like maybe each of you give like a.
Well, Gigi, where was your
one or two sentences. This is what I think this article is about.
Locked in the insecure.
So I'm going to go immediately towards some containerization thing that allows for root access of exporting. Like, so you, like, it's an insecure cage. So obviously there's holes in it, but you're still stuck into this thing. So broken OCI, like escalation or something to that point. Like basically find out that Kubernetes really doesn't actually do what we say it does or something like that. So something to that effect.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I've heard like some background dunking on Kubernetes lately. So I was wondering if whatever implementation of the container standard in the upstream release has some sort of known, you know, zero day or not so zero day anymore.
What is it? The CRI? Is that the one that CRI? We're doing now?
Or container? Yeah, the Container Runtime Initiative. Is that what it is?
Yeah, CRI.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe there's, to play off of Broberg, maybe there's a zero day in that we didn't know about and people have just been abusing the hell out of it.
I like this bounce off. I like this bounce. Good energy. Okay, Paul, tag in. Right. What happened?
Qui is the company behind Cellmate Chastity Cage, a Bluetooth-enabled device that fits around the genitals and is controlled via mobile app. So this is an article on a website called The Internet of Dongs.
I should have expected it.
Oh,
I should have expected it.
It's way lower brow than I expected. I'm
and,
yeah.
And this website is dedicated to
the art of dong,
Internet of Things, things that probably shouldn't be in a, on the internet, and doing penetration testing of them.
Oh,
in the digital sense, and by that I don't mean your finger.
Oh, Jesus.
So yeah, right. basically this device is insecure and a hacker can actually force it to lock and stay locked forever.
Wow. I actually choked on my beer.
So you realize you came in like...
Sorry, I did what?
No, damn it.
You came in hot and you really fizzled out.
Yeah. So we're already at peak, like we're already at peak, like statement here. Like how are we going to live up to this from now on? Like,
well,
like,
you can bring us down. Like you got to start these things with a bang.
Needless to say,
or a lock and key, I guess.
Oh God,
never to return. Well, I do have a really fun title that follows it. It is not nearly as much of a reveal. I'm going to skip the first word in it because it gives it away.
Are we going to double up?
Oh, yeah. I want to do this, too.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
I thought we would do one a week, but we can
piss off. We got to, like, give this a try.
We're iterating.
I want to give you the other title that I saw it listed when it had, like, other news agencies. I'm not sure that the Internet of Dongs project is really a news agency, but the other title that came up, which made it a little bit more obvious, but I love the title of, is... Smart male chastity lock cock up.
Oh,
which I thought was a great title. Well, but that didn't bury the lead nearly as much as
you wanted.
Locked in an insecure cage.
Okay. Paul, JJ, your turn to team up on this one. Architecture nihilism in minimalism clothes.
Wait, what was the last word? Closed?
Clothes. Like clothes, architecture, nihilism in minimalism's clothes.
I think clothes is the only word I understood in that entire thing.
So is it like, is it the i3 users of the world? No? Is that bad? Did I make a bad joke?
Was it nihilistic architectures in minimalist clothes? So like minimalist clothes, I'm guessing, is like your... Mark Zuckerberg, like, only wear like jeans and a black hoodie, and that's all I ever wear. And I guess that kind of fits the nihilism kind of side of things as well, because it's kind of a nihilistic kind of way of being, maybe. Mm-hmm. What's nihilism mean?
So, do you want
I'm done.
Do you want the common definition of nihilism, or do you actually, that was a perfect, nothing matters is actually the two word definition of nihilism.
Okay.
Just nothing most matters. People misappropriate that as a negative connotation by default when Nietzsche, who introduced the idea, just thought of it as a freeing concept. So I'm a big fan of it in theory.
It's almost like a Buddhist type concept then.
Yeah, when played to the philosopher's intention, it's very kind of Buddhist, except it's followed by his idea of will to power, which is pretty much like right is might and dominate the world with your mind. So, hit or miss.
I don't think Buddha was into that.
Okay. So we've got its component parts. We know architecture, probably talking about software, because we allegedly were going to talk about that on the show. So architecture, nihilism. So nothing matters in minimalism's clothes. What do you think that describes as a technology architecture?
So it is actually a technology architecture.
Hey!
yes, Paul. It is a specific technology architecture.
I don't know.
Fair. You give it a go. JJ, any guesses?
Oh, okay. I thought you were actually talking about like architectural nihilism in clothing, like as in like a brand of clothing.
Oh,
but I realize now you mean like a wolf in sheep's clothing.
It's play off of a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Right. See, I was way off I was way off.
I love it.
Well, in that case, it's like,
is the
be
gap
something.
Getting really dark lately?
It's got to be like Kubernetes related, because if you've seen any of the garbage that people try and do with Kubernetes and containers, it's clear that like nothing matters in the architecture of things. It all just gets thrown out the door and people do whatever nonsense thing they think will like get them a pay raise next, you know, cycle. Mm-hmm. So just yeah. like literally okay. anything modern software is what you're
so
describing.
I'll say Kubernetes adjacent. Good guess, Paul. JJ, you get one guess based on that. What do you think architecturally, very common architecture we talk about that is minimalistic and it leads to architectural nihilism?
I got to go with a stab in the dark of flat networking of like M192, 168, one whatever, /24.
No, where we don't care. Great guess. Great guess, though.
Come on, he's giving you hints. He's talking about microservices.
Yeah, nailed it.
Yeah, that was super obvious from your hints.
Come on, I was in the mental of like not listening to hints.
A mental
to
institution,
my
maybe.
Yeah.
He doesn't listen to my words. I appreciate that about JJ.
I have no idea.
Yeah, so this was a really brilliant long read from. From Vasco Figuerella, called Microservices, Architecture Nihilism in Minimalism's Clothes. And just talking about in short, it's a very thoughtful introduction to microservices from a skeptical point of view of what is its intended purpose, and then really trying to break down that, like, fundamentally, what is it achieving and not achieving by choosing for something to be architecturally, by definition, quote unquote, microservice from the beginning. To spoil it a tiny bit, it just gets to a point where you're saying, like, to build a sort of constraint around the size of the architecture arbitrarily without solving a particular problem is just fundamentally backwards, if not just really misguided. And the size and architectural layout will be based on far more than just, you know, a term like microservices. There's a lot of nuance to it that I'm skipping over because it's pretty deep on DAG creation. And how do you actually map out an architecture? But
wait,
I mean, what do you think?
DAG?
Yeah.
What was that term?
A DAG is a what? Oh, man, I don't remember.
Something graph,
oh,
right?
Directed acyclic graph.
Yeah.
Oh,
which is,
okay.
You know, a concept to talk about like dependency management and
got it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I was like, I'm doing that part from memory, but now I'm seeing the article. Yeah, it's how you map dependencies across a structure, a logical structure. So DAGs kind of tell you whether things depend on each other, and like there's so much out there about how people make microservices that accidentally depend on each other. So if one microservice is down, the whole system's down. So you really just made a very complex monolith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to that point, like there's so many times where a monolith can be a very effective tool given the right hardware and networking configuration. So I don't know, it's really interesting topic. What do you two experience on a...
was going to quickly mention that like that concept of the DAG and being aware of like all of your dependencies is super important if you're building things for other people to consume. And there's lots of them. So I know I spend a lot of time, for better or worse, with folks that are members of the Spring community, which is a framework for Java, which is kind of the go-to framework for Java for enterprise devs. And they have like all these things that basically help you do your job. And so there's libraries upon libraries upon libraries. And they at one point got into a bit of trouble where they had some weird dependencies where one thing depended on another thing, which depended back on the first thing and sort of created like that cyclical dependency. And so they actually like build out their DAG and then check for cyclical dependencies across the entire set of tooling and frameworks.
That's so cool.
To make sure that like nothing new is brought in. And I think they have like two or three like legacy dependencies that they still haven't fully gotten rid of, but they're known, so they can then work with them. So I think that's a good example where they're important. And while that's not exactly microservices, it is in that same vein of you have all these things that are separate but can be super dependent on each other. On the actual topic of microservices, one of the things I've felt about microservices is they're often used as a way to reduce one person's incompetence to affect other things. You know, often at large companies, for better or worse, you get this feeling where they're trying to like bring everything down to the point where someone who is like at the like barely competent like place can still have an impact, right? So
are you saying
you know how to write
containerizing that person, Jane or Billy Joe over there, and putting them in a little service, like containerize them? There's a joke there.
There's not a joke there.
Where we're going, we don't need jokes.
So and so much like
can you step back and maybe dig into what do you mean by incompetence? Because
I think there's that common thing of like at a large company, everyone's just a cog in the machine, and those cogs are like replaceable and interchangeable and don't have any expertise other than being round with notches that turn, right? And so in that way of looking at things, then you start being like, well, if these are interchangeable, if they're all looking the same, none of them have like, you know, specific skill, like specific expertise or whatever. And therefore we need to accommodate for that and build a framework in which you can kind of just plug someone in anywhere and have them be effective, right? And so if you have a microservice, if you're thinking about things where, you know, I've heard people go to the point with if a function has more than 8 lines, it's too big, right? There's like schools of thought that go that way. And like, when that's the case, then like, there's not a lot of expertise needed to maintain 8 lines of code, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of breaking things down into manageable chunks, but maybe going way too far by assuming that like, that's the maximum that people can deal with, versus most people can actually hold a decent amount of like systems thinkings in their brain. Like, yeah,
there.
I think I probably got my point across.
I think so. I want to jump onto one point I really like in there. Like, so I was poking at incompetence because I don't think people trying to do their job is like,
no,
they end up being labeled.
I wasn't saying incompetent. I was saying barely competent.
Barely competent. Okay. So that's more a function of like, do you have the skills to do the job in front of you? And I think that is a fair discrepancy. Yeah.
And I'm also talking about, and I maybe didn't make clear, like people's assumptions, not necessarily reality.
I see. Okay. Well, yeah, I really love the point you made about, you know, trying to, you know, really abstract individuals, call them cogs, you know, pay them in bands and shuffle them around as if that won't impact the production of a massively complex software system. It's like when people playing Conway's Law consider every, you know, every unit of person in an org interchangeable, as if there's no domain specific knowledge that needs to be shared somehow. Yeah, you can end up with some really messy stuff if the assumption is, well, we've adopted microservices, so now every new software developer at level 4 should be able to produce a new microservice on team Z. You're like, That's not how it works. There's so much context that you're attempting to abstract ineffectively.
Yeah.
In a quick brief, Conway's Law is just the production of systems based on org charts is the short version of it. And if you're in an organization really over one person, you'll end up experiencing it in no time. Just like, why are we doing it this way? Oh, this other team's doing it differently because we report to different people. It's not just a pejorative though. There is some really interesting value to it, but it is a challenge.
Back, and read the original papers.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really interesting, thoughtful stuff that we all gloss over when we use it as a, like a pejorative to like laugh about some, you know, stupid company making bad software.
Yeah.
Well, can I ask?
Yeah.
This, so obviously what y'all are describing of band four can do X or do X on Z project or whatever, right? The idea is that you should be able to take an engineer or developer or whatever you want to call that person to be able to use their skills in different locations throughout the business to make sure the business is successful. Now, do you think that's tainted by the idea of what the assembly line of our manufacturing used to have, where the idea is you could take that cog or that part of the finished good and put it onto the machine in different locations. And we're trying to put something that is a knowledge worker in the point of when you can put in a cog. Does that make sense? Did I make a couple too many jumps there?
No, I think I hear what you're saying. I'll repeat it back that you're saying like, is this really a function of a bad metaphorical leap from the kind of command or like not the command line through the production line of a car to software and knowledge work? Like is it just a gap there or is there something else going on?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like there is.
Paul, I felt like you were gonna jump in. I've got thoughts, of course.
I do have thoughts. I will try and keep these ones brief. But I think in a way, yes, but I think it's more about low trust work environments, right? So you have, what are the three cultures? You've got pathological, you've got even startup. Worse than pathological, and then you've got like productive. I can't remember this.
Oh, startups can be pathological.
Yeah. There's like three culture types, which I can't remember the actual official ones.
DevOps, DevSecOps.
I hate you so much.
DevBiz, ML... Ops. Sec. Did I get the dart in there?
I had to.
Paul's visibly angry.
I'm not angry much.
Continue. You were trying to make
I think
point
I think
culture.
that was I wanted to keep it short and then throw it to you because I think you were probably in the same kind of area of what you were thinking.
Yeah, you know, I think it's like a lossy attempt at understanding what was happening on the assembly line, because in our modern idea of it, you're like, oh, you know, they mastered that back then, so we can apply it now, and somebody in this part of the assembly line can go to that part. But like, that's not the takeaway I have from the Toyota Kata or any of the work of Deming. It's like building a utility, a functional supply chain doesn't mean each part of the supply chain is interchangeable. That actually doesn't make any sense. You wouldn't put a cog that fits in part five in part three because there's a dependency order.
Exactly.
And the people, like, and let's not forget, like, we're not just messing with the cogs, we're really messing with the people that make the cogs. And you can be really good at making a certain type of cog and absolutely terrible at making another kind.
I think
different models of that I really appreciate.
Actually, a really good point that you just kind of made, which is like, there's not really any such thing as a general purpose cog. Like literally every cog is like super specific to perform a very specific function. And you join different cogs together to like create a machine that's like way bigger and way more powerful than the sum of the parts.
Yeah. I mean, even when you look at wedges, which are one of the simplest machines we have as human beings, like they're pretty complex.
Yeah.
Like, and the exact angle and material you're using to make them can be complex. If you take a step back and appreciate the complexity, you know, fast forward to software where we're creating these acyclical graphs of dependencies across billions of lines of code that were made over the last 70 years. To varying degrees of update. And you're like, go have a ball, like go be good at that.
Yeah.
No, it's insane amounts of complexity, but that also that's something no one wants to hear either, because that's right. A pretty, you know, naive excuse of why we can't change.
Yeah. And like microservices aren't like, we're not saying they're a bad thing, but God, like no. with everything else, you've got to do these things with like deliberation and thought. Like everyone has to have a good idea of where their piece fits into the system, right? And you also need people that are experts in the system that can help eliminate waste, right? Because if no one else knows what the rest of the system does, you end up just duplicating what other people have done, right? You reduplicate other parts of the software because you don't even know they're there. And so you do need, and this is where like your, I guess your enterprise architecture type person comes in. You need those folks to ensure that each like microservice or each piece that comes together to form the greater piece of software is doing so in a sensible and mindful way. And that I feel that's one of the things that a lot of people, a lot of organizations don't do well, is really shepherd like the larger product at the end, because they're so busy, like focused in at the individual, like, you know, scrum teams or the individual, like whatever, however you're breaking it down. And just quick, jump back to what I was just talking about, cultures. So I was trying to remember it was like the Westrum's three types of cultures, and it was pathological, bureaucratic, and generative.
I thought it was Westy 12, Westy 8. Hey, come on.
That's Wes Bettleren, sir. and I would bet you that all three of us have worked absolutely in a pathological and or bureaucratic organization, and probably still do. And we may have been lucky enough to work in a generative one.
Yeah, but I can.
I would say a lot of folks have not properly experienced like a generative culture.
Yeah, I'm like fewer than 3 years out of 12 in right. corporate IT.
Yeah. Yeah. and I don't think they're like hard and fast. There's definitely like, it's, you know, kind it's of a spectrum thing. And spectrum. Like you can have generative components in a pathological culture and stuff. But it is an interesting way to like frame like the place you're working at. And the other thing is like, if you know the company you work for has a pathological culture, you can then use that to your advantage, right?
Yeah.
So knowing more about your culture and the company is really good for your career. Now you don't want your pathological culture to turn you into a pathological human being. Right. Yeah. So you're the kind of person that sort of absorbs the culture of the company you work at. That can be really, really dangerous. But if you're not that and you can figure out how to work the culture, it can be great.
There's a phrase that I really enjoy about that. That's we all drink what we swim in. That ultimately we're all fish floating in something, and whatever we're floating in, whether it's by the definition of unconscious, we will absorb that. We will end up drinking that in. So I'll say, no matter how mentally tough you are, maybe you can survive in any of those spaces and thrive for a while, but don't pretend that it's not affecting you outside of work.
For sure.
We all bring that stuff home. But great breakdown and fascinatingly applies well to the thought from JJ on Conway's Law all the way through to this great use of nihilism in a tech title. That made me really happy.
So did we actually resolve what you're... We did.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I think we...
This was fun.
Were we like halfway there? Did we get close when I realized that it was wolf in sheep's clothing?
Yeah. No, as soon as you hit that, I think it clicked for you. Yeah. And JJ was still playing. He landed on the network thing, which, you know, what's microservices without networking problems?
True.
Oh, there is no networking in microservices. That's someone else's problem.
It's all a flat network. Nobody cares.
That's what Kubernetes does.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, so actually I was having a discussion with a really smart developer friend of mine the other day. Like, I'd been helping him do some Kubernetes stuff and kind of learn some of the basics.
Well, I know we were talking the other day.
And he started asking questions about, well, if you have these like backing services, like databases and message queues, and you're doing CI/CD and you're doing GitOps, like, where are those backing services getting installed and who's managing them? And I'm like, that's the question, isn't it? And if you're part of like the you know, the 12 factor like cult, you're like, someone else.
Yep. It's just an API endpoint. That's all it is.
But at the end of the day, someone's got to run that API endpoint, and sometimes it is you.
Yeah, it's true. That is true. All right, gentlemen, I feel like we're pretty much at a good spot here. Do we want to say goodbye or any final thoughts? I feel like we actually put together a relatively good podcast today. Just saying.
There you are, breaking the fifth screen again.
Stop. Yeah, stop breaking the screens, JJ. Just be in, just swim in this with us. Cool. So yes to bringing back the whatever you called this segment.
Mm-hmm. Buried the meme.
And then we have to find a witty name by next episode. Let's find a witty name for whatever we do when we talk about food very poorly. And Paul explains. Maybe it's just called Paul Explains.
Paul Explains. Seems reasonable.
Paul Explaining.
Paul Explaining.
Oh, we're done here. This is perfect. Yep. Good to see you too.
All right, guys.
Bye, guys.